Hello, welcome to the ZX Spectrum. My name's Lizzie Hodgson.
And my name's Brenna Ralph.
And the ZX Spectrum, we take an intergenerational look at all things digital and tech. And very excited today because we're going to be celebrating International Women's Day, which is today. And we have a very special guest, Caroline Walmsley, who is co-founder of Further My Future. But before we get into the chat with Caroline, I want to just give you a quick reminder for you to jump into other ZX Spectrum episodes. This week alone, we released a podcast on AI and the future of work. And it's a very, very interesting kind of like debate and conversation that came out of this event that we ran. And it covers things like, if robots take your job, what then? What is the universal basic income? Future of education and young people actually having a purpose through work. And what happens if that work is taken away from them? Where will they find that purpose?
Yeah, and it's got a lot of interesting guests that we brought onto it. And it's got a very, very interesting and diverse panel. It's a really good listen.
So that's a good one, but this is going to be a good one too. So hello, Caroline.
Hi there.
Hi. Thank you so much for joining us today. Do you want to do a quick intro of yourself?
I'm Caroline. I am the CEO and co-founder of Further My Future, as you very kindly mentioned. Further My Future is an application that is designed to connect young people to careers information about apprenticeship opportunities and for employers to connect with young people who are seeking apprenticeship opportunities.
So why did you start Further My Future?
The professional or the personal?
Both.
Professional is because we felt there was a better way for young people to be informed about apprenticeships and for employers to find young people who were interested in apprenticeships. The journey there was a little bit longer than that. Do you want to talk a little bit
about
that?
Always, okay. About the journey.
So the journey to it was, I'd run and helped sell a couple of companies. One was a publishing house and one was a learning technologies company. And I'd taken a bit of a career break. I'd hit 40 and I was totally fine with it.
Brian was like, what's 40?
Yeah. 40.
Wait. Totally fine with it. And I just thought, you know, I wonder what I'm going to do next. And took up a bit of consulting work. And what was really important to me at that point is that I'd kind of followed a path of taking opportunities that had come to me in my career just to see if I could and what was next. And it all worked out very, very well. I was very fortunate. But I'd kind of done what was next and then got to that point and thought, okay, I still, where's the meaning in all of this?
Right.
So the pursuit of profit had been great, but profit with purpose was also something that was quite important to me as well. So I took on some different consultancy gigs, one of whom was with an apprenticeship provider. And I'd never worked in that industry before at all. I always say my only experience of you know, young people was like centuries ago. I was one. That's it.
It's there.
Yeah. It was absolutely fantastic. They're a brilliant organisation. But what struck me was the young people that they were working with. And they worked with young people in Hampshire, in Sussex, and in London. Were people that, for whatever reason, had decided that university wasn't right for them. They didn't want to go. They couldn't go. Whatever the reason was. And just in speaking with these young people and working within this business, I suddenly realised just how privileged I had been and just how much harder it was for young people if the UCAS pathway wasn't the right pathway for them and that there didn't seem to me to be a valid or meaningful alternative that they didn't have to work very, very hard to find. So I thought that was quite interesting and that was something that we could look into. Around that time as well, the apprenticeship levy was being talked about quite a lot.
Do you want to explain what the apprenticeship levy is?
The apprenticeship levy is effectively a charge that was introduced in 2017. Any companies that have a salary bill of over £3 million, I think it is, a year, are required to pay 0.5% into a levy pot in their organisation, which must be then spent on apprenticeship training or they lose it within a two-year period. So the government had introduced that as an incentive for a range of different reasons to help address the skills gap in the UK economy and to help promote vocational education as well as academic education.
How have apprenticeships and attitudes towards them changed, you know, in the past few years, or, you know, why are they a viable option for young people today?
I think the introduction of the levy and what sort of prompted it, which was a government review of apprenticeships, meant that, you know, as a country we'd recognise that they probably weren't working as well as they might. They weren't necessarily equipping young people with the skills that they needed to get jobs that employers wanted. The training wasn't as perhaps as good as it might have been, and you know, employers weren't creating enough apprenticeship opportunities. So the introduction of the levy and various different, you know, sort of audits were designed to change that. And I think that's worked. We're now seeing, and we're working with a number of employers who are creating some fantastic opportunities. I think that attitudes, though, are still sort of trailing slightly slower behind that.
Attitudes in where, though?
Attitudes towards apprenticeships. I think that, you know, primarily schools and careers informations, you know, the priority is UCAS. So that's what we're hearing a lot from the young people that we're working with. Teachers and careers advisors are incredibly sort of stretched. They're time poor. They're dealing with a lot of information and a lot of students. So, and the schools are measured on you know, sort of destination to universities as well.
Do you think this sort of leads to young people today, like Gen Z, not being able to make informed decisions about sort of their next steps and their futures because they don't necessarily have the full options and the full scale available?
I think the key word there is informed, and it's about not only informed options but informed choice. I think that if you know or you think that university might be right for you, a pathway is laid out in front of you. A huge mm-hmm. amount of your academic calendar will be spent preparing you for your UCAS application, thinking about your personal statement, going through all of those steps. If you want to do something else, the onus is on you to go and find out, you know, other sources of information. Invariably, you're pointed to a government website, which, you know, I found to be sort of, you know, impenetrable most of the time. So I think it's about access to information in order to be able to make an informed choice.
Yeah, well, I think the interesting thing is, because, well, I'm 18 and I've just come through sort of the school system, and the school system is very much about driving you onto the sort of next academic path and the next thing. So I went to Bastwick in Brighton, which is sort of a very high achieving college, and it was very much about sort of getting you onto university and things like that. Now, I do the university part-time while working, study at the Open University, but I'm seeing like more and more people doing apprenticeships and looking down those schemes. Yep. More and more people sort of understanding. Like, I bumped into a friend of mine the other day from school that had just finished an apprenticeship at BMW doing engineering and things like that. And I really think it sort of opens doors. But I do sort of feel that there is almost like a stigma around the idea of like going to an apprenticeship rather than going to university, particularly when you're more sort of academic. Obviously, I've been quite fortunate in my work that I, you know, I purely go to university for the fun of going to university rather than needing to go for a job or anything like that. But I'm curious to hear your views on what you think the opinion of the youth of today is on sort of doing an apprenticeship.
I am the last person you want to ask to speak on behalf of the youth today, but I think the important thing is that what is right for you is not necessarily right for the person that stood next to you. Mm-hmm. And I feel passionately that one pathway shouldn't be you know, perceived as being better than another. I absolutely believe that university is right for some students. No question at all. All I'm sort of, you know, the young people that we're working with, they're sort of saying to you, actually, we know it's not right for us. And increasingly, that's for a range of different reasons that are so far removed from academic ones. That's been surprising to me as well. The introduction of fees, the weight of university debt, the lack of guarantee about a graduate job, what a graduate opportunity might offer these days. These are all sort of concerns that the young people that we're working with are coming to us and saying, well, yeah, I could go to university. And in many cases, their parents want them to go to university, their teachers want them to go to university, but they're feeling an overwhelming pressure that actually it might not be right for them.
I'm curious actually as well to hear your sort of what you think around the value of a university education compared to maybe 20 years ago or 30 years ago today than it used to be. Because in my opinion, from coming from a standpoint where we used to hire people, so at the peak of the company we had like 40 people. Yep. And all of them went through hiring, and lots of them were sort of young people. I think our average age was about 17-16, and we found that we never ever looked at their education background or anything like that. It was purely based off of the skills and sort of the what you could demonstrate to us. So we would do like a trial period at the start so we could really gauge who you were as a person.
Yeah.
And if you fit into our team, and also as well if your skills were up there. And that came more from like experience, which I find comes from sort of apprenticeship driven than that. Because, you know, like I do university and I'm already seeing, you know, I'm doing courses at the moment where they're already far dated behind what is current. I mean, I'm studying marketing and the marketing methods they use, I don't even use in my work anymore, just because they're so dated. And I wonder if, do you think, you know, maybe apprenticeships are a bit more valuable than university?
Are apprenticeships more valuable than university? I think there's two questions in there that you asked. The first one is in terms of how I think it's changed. Mm-hmm. I went to university 20 years ago and degree, and I came out of university and needed some money, so I got a job in an off licence. And the guy I was working with there, his mum was a proofreader, and I thought, that sounds really glamorous. Manuscripts, black coffee, I'm going to go into publishing. This was it. Wrote to a load of publishers and got a job with one. And I was like, yes, this is fantastic. I've got my degree, brilliant. I've got a job in publishing, fantastic. I spent 6 months opening the post. There was nothing about my degree that meant that I was more qualified to open an envelope than, you know, all I required was opposable digits. That was it. So that's fine. But there was the attitude then that if you want this entry level job, you need a degree. Nothing like the enlightened sort of experience checking that you're talking about. I think attitudes have changed these days, and I think it's also not necessarily even a question of either or. I mean, you know, degree apprenticeships, I think, offer a fantastic route for, mm-hmm. for young people to be able to, you know, develop work experience and practical skills, as well as academic achievement and, you know, avoid university debt. I think your point about the currency of the content on your course is also really valid. Brighton is, you know, a super digital, super creative, you know, city and economy. Hundreds of you know, design and development agencies, all of whom saying, actually, we only take graduates coming into our organisations, but actually once they get in there, we've got to train them because they don't know that, you know, their coding's not up to date. So I don't necessarily think it's as clear cut as either or. I think there are, you know, both offer advantages, and I think attitudes are changing, but, you know, slowly, I think.
Where would you like them to be in sort of, you know, 5 to 10 years time?
I would love to be in a position where a vocational education pathway is seen as valid as an academic mm-hmm. one. And I think that, because I think that both are equally valid, and I think it depends on the skills that an employer requires and the skills that a young person wants to develop. I think the problem with sort of, you have to benchmark everything. That's what qualifications are all about, whether it's a degree qualification or apprenticeship qualification. But the problem with that is it doesn't really measure potential, I don't think. And potential is only something that you see once you're in an environment and you're gaining experience and building on that.
I think that that's also an interesting thing, because apprenticeships get to meet different people within that organisation.
Yeah.
And I think that what's also very important for people, particularly young people, is to have like that idea of role models and evidence. And we had a podcast with Sharon Davies a couple of weeks ago with Young Enterprise, and she said, you can't be what you can't see.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a really important message. And so surely getting young people into an organisation, firstly, they will bring new ideas in,
definitely,
which is what absolutely is required, I think, now more than ever. But also you have an opportunity to inspire those young people. So it might be that you have young people come into your organisation who are passionate about working, or different, and dare I say it, have less of an entitlement feeling around that work, which I think sometimes can come across with some graduates. You know, not that I've had that experience firsthand, but I've heard this, you know, that you can have a sense of entitlement when you get a degree. And the idea that you have to work to get to something isn't, I don't think, I mean, Brandon and I have slightly different views of this. Working in an organisation to get experience, to gain experience, to move your way through up, I don't think is anything bad. And I think that that's the benefit of having, you know, starting in a role like, you know, getting into a company at a young age.
And to fight my core.
Yes.
I don't necessarily disagree with that idea, but I am seeing, and I'd be curious to see if through the young people you've worked through, there's sort of this idea in the head of the youth today of being able to climb that ladder a lot quicker, and rather than wanting to, you know, like you said, when you first started, you went, you know, punching letters, rather than doing jobs like that, they want to jump straight into sort of the higher level jobs, and rather than working from the bottom of an organisation, want to come in at the middle because they really think that they can contribute something.
I honestly, the young people that we're seeing with, I'm not necessarily seeing that. What I am seeing is, and what's been a real, actually a bit of a shock to me, and I think this could be a generational spectrum thing, is what really matters is not the level that they're going in at, but the culture of the organisation, mm-hmm. and the values of the organisation, and what potential there is for growth and development for them within it. So we've worked with a number of young people where we've been saying to them, this is a fantastic employer with a great opportunity, you match on a range of different, you know, range of different areas, but actually they'll say, you know, it doesn't, culturally doesn't look like the right fit for me, it doesn't look like the type of organisation that I see myself in.
It's like when I was hiring people back in the day, we would hire them mostly on the basis of how they fit into our organisation, yeah. and if they fit into our culture. Like, we had a large talent pool we could pick from, so we could afford to be slightly picky,
yeah.
and we were just around that. And it's interesting as well that you point out that they're like looking ahead for growth and yeah. stuff like that. So I think, although they may not want to jump in the middle, they probably want to be accelerating upwards slightly quicker than, you know, maybe was prior.
I definitely think, you know, if your question is who's more ambitious, is it a graduate or is it an apprentice? Equal. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Ambition. Yeah. Ambition is a preserve of no, you know, one particular group. So, you know, all of the young people that we are working with have, you know, they've got drive and they've got ambition, and they want, more than anything, they want the opportunity to prove themselves. But I think, you know, the match, this sort of culture thing where you're saying about the values mapping in your hiring choice, what I'm really interested in us doing and exploring is making that more of a two-way street. So at the moment, the power is all with the employers. It's, you know, do you fit us? And I'm interested in being able for the young people to be able to look at an employer and go, actually, what have you got to offer me? What's it like to work there? And is that going to sit well with me?
Well, I think some of the work that I do is all about, like, nowadays, young people can obviously search for jobs a lot easier and have a variety. You know, maybe it's, you know, the same level of difficulty to get jobs, but it comes down to this cultural thing. And there's almost, you know, like Lizzie and I have had discussions about this before. I think bureaucratic structures are ridiculous, and I think one day they'll all fall. But
in my defence, I think bureaucratic structures are ridiculous. I was talking about the way that I think sometimes you have to work your way through something.
No, I don't disagree. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I mean, what I'm finding now is there's an excitement with young people to do new and different things. And sometimes I think the worst thing organisations can do all the time, and this is a point that I've said in my TEDx talk, and I've said, you know, like I say in most of my talks, is organisations are sometimes very bad at listening to young people.
Yeah.
Like some, I don't know what your experience has been with employers, but I found that they ask questions about, you know, how can we, you know, interact with young people better, you know, whether that is for marketing or that is for sort of HR. It's and you know, I think the simple answer sometimes is literally to sit down and talk to them. And it's interesting that you link it with the culture, and I think it is about sort of young people finding, you know, being able to have a voice to be able to talk in and tell them. And I think so many organisations would learn and be able to understand a lot more young people if they actually, you know, sat in a room with them and spoke to them.
Perfect.
And I think apprenticeships can be a good way to do that in some ways. I feel like it's very much a cultural sort of thing of, like, you know, the older you are, the more wise you are, when sometimes it's about listening to everybody in a discussion.
I think there's also another step beyond that. So talk, listen, and then when people, young people in particular, come up with ideas of what they want to try out, get out of the way. Don't be that blocker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, step out of the way and give them the tools and give them the platform to do what they want to do, to try something out, because you just don't know whether they could do something better.
Yeah.
Because I think that we all get into the habit, as we get older, we do get into a mind frame that this is my experience and this is how things should be done. And the whole construct of the workplace reinforces that. But if we are to, you know, one of my big things is to create the opportunities and the structures for young people to thrive, to solve the challenges that they're inheriting, that we have created, We can't, on the one hand, say, you know, you've got to solve these problems, but you're going to solve it in the framework within which we made those problems. Yeah. And so it has to be sit down, listen, talk, and then get out of the way.
I think that's right. But I think, you know, for me, key in you know, my experience of working with employers and young people seeking apprenticeships is listening is crucial. You're absolutely right. But you've got to be speaking the same language as well. The vocabulary really, really, really matters. And that's where we're seeing, you know, a huge disconnect between the young people that we're working and the employers that we're working with. They, you know, we will spend huge amounts of time and effort and resource and money creating, you know, brand presence and brand awareness and, you know, promoting vacancies that they have, but in a language that actually is not necessarily immediately either accessible or attractive to the young people that they're trying to.
I've seen loads and loads of examples of that myself, of like different things, and you're like, well, no, I'd never want to, you know, I see this and I'm like, no, I'd never want to work there. Yeah. It doesn't seem like the sort of thing that comes out, you know. Like I think maybe one of the best ways to do that is that I've said to a couple of organizations is, wouldn't it be cool if you created like a video that, you know, we could watch and we could understand what goes on, you know, behind closed doors and what goes on in your organization, and be able to then almost, you know, like understand it that way rather than giving me a list of the qualities you want.
I'm really surprised companies don't do that
though. No, I'm really surprised as well.
This is almost as though you're leading me to an advert, and I swear it is. but I think the video piece is really important, and that's, I thought, you know, the flip side of that is it's immediately accessible then for young people to see what it's like to be in a particular organisation. But equally, the apprentices that we're working with, or want to be apprentices that we're working with, they don't have banks of work experience. They don't have CVs. So actually, video, I think, represents a really powerful mechanism for them being able to present themselves.
And it's a very accessible, even playing field thing to get to.
Well, you can film a video on your smartphone now. I mean, sometimes people ask me for videos for stuff, and I literally have like a little tripod and I sit my phone on there because I don't see the point in getting a big camera, so I just sit and talk into the camera for a couple of minutes, and then I can edit it on free, iMovie on a Mac, or, you know, free software on Windows, and you can just make this cool video, you know, in a couple of hours that you can then advertise. And I think doing that as well almost teaches you different skills as well, like making that image will help sort of disconnect between that.
But the thing is that you've got the structures within the company that make it very difficult, because that's the hierarchies and the marketing and all these different structures. What I do want to get onto is this idea of kind of role models.
Yeah.
Role models are really important. And what role models did you have when you were growing up?
I've thought a lot about this. Role models, I think, are really, really important, but I think modelling behaviours has always been more important to me than modelling people. I think it's about sort of, you know, finding your own sort of sense of self and you know, truth and voice and all those sorts of things. I was really lucky, I had a brilliant childhood, but there were no really sort of atypical female role models around me. I was very aware of you know, having a job, but the idea of a career or a profession just was totally alien to me. And I think, if you know, if I'm completely honest, it was sort of, you know, mid-teens, I sort of found myself drifting along a pathway that just would have seen history repeating itself, and until I sort of thought, actually, no, I want something slightly different. And I think, going back to your earlier point about networks, I think it was only actually sort of, you know, being able to leave home and, you know, experience different things and meet different people, be exposed to lots of different types of opportunities, that really made me think, oh, actually, there's a wealth of opportunities available to me, I think, that hadn't been there when I was growing up.
So role models for young people, do you think it is more around modelling behaviours? And if it is modelling behaviours, where do they find that?
I think that's the key thing. I think it's about having, I think, role models that offer inspiration and, you know, people that you want to sort of emulate, fantastically, but we all do, you know, really need those. It's, you know, it is important, but it's also, I think it's role models can be immediately accessible. They don't have to be people that are on pedestals that have never made a mistake in their lives. I think they can be people that are actually just able to show you a range of different possibilities, to show you that actually it's okay to try something and not succeed at it, and actually, you know, live to tell the tale. And I think that for young people, that sort of awareness of possibilities isn't just in terms of you know, role models, and if you can't, you know, if you can't sort of see it, you can't be it. It's also, you know, we've got a catchphrase for Further My Future, which is how can you choose to be something you've never heard of. It's also about access to information and knowing, you know, to come back to your point earlier about being able to make an informed choice. So I think absolutely role models are important. I don't think they have to be, you know, superstar role models, though that's great too. It could be anyone in this room, I think. It's but it's also about access to information.
It's also about identifying yourself as a role model. I think that if you don't realise that you could have that positive impact, it could be a wasted opportunity. And I think that by identifying yourself as a role model, knowing that you are, you then need to step up and perhaps, you know, just do something.
Definitely.
You know, it's down to us to actually also go the other way. Just expect young people to come to us, but actually do it the other way.
Yeah, and I think absolutely that's a two-way street as well. So, you know, in our organisation, got a young woman. I'm fortunate enough to mentor a young teenage girl, and I learn probably more from them than they would, you know, learn from me. It's absolutely, they are role models for me. So I think it's really important, as you say, to be able to identify and not just seek to find those sorts of people in one place.
I think it's really important to learn, like you say there, but she probably learnt lots of information from you that she could have never learnt in any other way than doing that. That does become sort of a two-way street. I mean, like Lizzie and I, we do like different things together, don't we? And I think it's always a two-way street with what
definitely.
We discuss. Lizzie definitely. Will come and say that, and I'll be like, no, Lizzie, that's stupid. and then Lizzie will be like, call some of my stuff stupid as well.
Yeah. so it's a positive
and I've just found it so in my entire career, it's always about who you talk to and who you network with. I mean, my entire business and my entire thing has just come off of who I know and who I do that.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you talk about role models that are big and out there, and I've been lucky to meet, you know, a lot of mine through my work, but the thing you very quickly realise is that they're just, you know, people.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, I did like an interview with Steve Wozniak, who co-founded Apple, and he rocked up to the interview in trainers, you know, because, you know, who cares?
Yeah.
And he, you know, was somebody that, you know, you think, oh, wow. But at the end of the day, he's just a normal guy that, you know, has normal discussions. I did feel, coming off of that, really excited about what young people were doing. I was obviously excited about his work.
I think that's really important, that you are also accessible and that you don't ever get kind of like
complacent.
And also that you think that you are above it all. Because one of the things
I hate people like that.
One of the things that genuinely keeps me grounded is I'm not exactly, you know, I'm by no means, you know, up there. But however, I have had experiences and I have had, you know, and I have been in, you know, I've worked in some amazing places and I've had access to some incredible people. But I always remember that feeling of kind of like not quite knowing and not understanding and not knowing where I fitted in.
Yeah.
And if you can tap into that, I think that empathy with somebody else is really, really important.
I think empathy is hugely important. And it's also just about demonstrating the art of the possible. You know, Steve rocks up in trainers and you immediately identify with that. And you think, actually, you know, maybe I'm on that. I could be on that trajectory as well. And I think, you know, empathy really matters. And it's about being able to connect with that person, whether it's the trainers or because, you know, they weren't sure about where they were going. Either, whatever it is.
I mean, I just find it so, like, I met like Elon Musk in like at a Minecraft convention a few years ago, and he was there with his kids, and you're like, oh yeah, you know, he does do all this, you know, big, he runs like multiple large companies, but you know, he still has children and he still, you know, goes on holiday with his children and does that.
He's still human, and that's the connection. That's surely the greatest connection that we all have, is that we're all human at the end
of
the day. And I think within organisations, you've got to remember, like, and organisations themselves have got to remember that the people within the organisations are just people. Like, all it is just people. Like, the people hiring the people are just people hiring people. And the people managing the people that are hiring the people are all people. And, you know, sometimes I think this idea maybe of not being grounded and thinking, oh, you know, like, you know, I'm at the top of the food chain or whatever.
There is no such thing.
There is no, like, you're still a human being. And
absolutely.
You can still, you know.
Elon Musk should have walked away from that encounter thinking, what could I have learned from you?
I think he's learned a lot. So, thinking around all of those kinds of things, and as this is International Women's Day, you know, what specific advice, or do you have any specific advice for young women who want to kind of like build on their own or create this, like, their own initiative like you did?
I think that the fact that you want to try is already enough. That's brilliant, because I think so many people just don't have that. I think that, you know, God, the lessons I've learned, I think, you know, I would focus on the what you want and why you want it, because the how, a million people can come out and help you with the how, but knowing what it is you want, and more importantly why, will I think bring those people with you. The other thing, you know, if I'm honest to touch upon, is that, you know, imposter syndrome is a very real thing for a lot of women. Absolutely, I suffer from it.
I suffer from it. Yeah. So, do you understand what imposter syndrome is?
No, not really.
Okay. So my interpretation of imposter syndrome is that I feel I am not adequately skilled or have the knowledge or the experience or the expertise to be doing what I'm doing, and that at some point somebody's going to find me out.
I think it's quite a female thing. It's the inner critic. And
not good enough.
Yeah, or whatever, you know, whatever your last achievement was, is you absolutely should be able to do more, or you should have done it better, or you should have done it faster, or whatever it is. And I think that learning to tune that critic out is absolutely key. And I've sort of learned that, you know, she might never actually go away, but she's never been helpful to me. So I think embracing it, accepting it, moving on. I think try is the key word in all of that. I think that women, particularly, such pressure on women to look perfect, to be perfect. The concept of having it all for women drives me absolutely crackers.
It is the most damaging narrative.
Yeah, I agree. And so the idea that you have what is right for you. Try, and if it doesn't work, that's okay too. Enjoy the journey. Don't be so focused on the outcome that you kind of, you know, miss the ride. So I think, you know, for me, I would sort of say to women that are out there thinking, you know, I might start my own thing, do it. Just do it. There'll be a million reasons why you think you might not be able to do it. There'll be a million reasons why you think you won't succeed. And none of that really matters. Just try and see what happens.
And I think what I'm planning to do this year as well, which I haven't said publicly or anything, is I'm planning on hopefully producing content in some form of way that will better be able to guide you on how to deal with all the logistics and all the stuff that comes around it. So, you know, if you want to start up your own company, there's a ton of like legal side of it as well, but then there's also a ton of like, you know, trying and things like that. But hopefully to build up the resources to be able to make it a lot easier for sort of young people to know where they can get access to, you know, business bank accounts, you know, how to, you know, file taxes and how to do that sort of stuff. And that's one of my aims over the next sort of year, is to build the resources around doing that.
And then you could launch it on International Women's Day next year.
I'm hoping to launch it way before then.
So what the International Women's Day theme for this year, for 2019, is think equal, build smart, innovate for change. And I'm just going to read this. The UN states this puts innovation by women and girls, for women and girls, at the heart of efforts to achieve gender equality. So what does that kind of statement mean? Does it mean anything?
Yes, I think of course it means something. I think for me, it's about, There's two things in that. The first one, I think, when we talk about International Women's Day, inclusion is really important to me, and I'll just keep coming back to that. The second one is about how innovation can disrupt the status quo, about how, you know, we can be encouraging, via access to information, women to be contributing more in the workplace, creating, bringing their creativity, producing more, you know, design, services, concepts, and actually having that be invested back into the female community and promoting change from within.
I'm really interested to hear your views as well on how you think that, you know, from both of you, how you think that that's different from when you were younger to the young people that are growing up and coming into the workplace today.
Well, for me, I was clueless, to be honest. And I think that this is an interesting thing that I might say. So bad was my imposter syndrome, was I thought that I was unemployable, that I thought that if I went to work for somebody else, I would just fail because I wasn't going to ever be good enough. And it was one of the drivers that made me actually want to do things on my own, because I just thought, at the end of the day, the only person I'm really going to disappoint is myself. and I've got exceptionally high expectations of myself. And so my fear kind of like of letting people down has been driven, has been actually one of the things that's been one of my greatest successes. Right, yeah. You know, it's a very peculiar thing. But I think that what's happened in change in the workplace, I think from what I'm seeing, so, you know, with the kind of like exposure I've had with organisations like Accenture, who are phenomenal for getting their, you know, gender equality and diversity efforts, they're amazing. I didn't realise that organisations could be like that.
Mm.
Because when I was, you know, looking at jobs and going into jobs, it was a different climate. This is back in the 90s.
Yeah.
And it was a very, very different climate. And the idea that it was almost like you worked because that was all you did. There was no conversation around, we need to make sure that we have, you know, we are onboarding correctly, that we are building a culture, an inclusive culture. There was no conversations around that. I have worked in some horrific places. I've worked in places where there has been absolute blatant homophobia, blatant racism, sexism. I was once given a job. I was made editor of a magazine, and the ex-editor was male. I was female, and I was offered the job. I said, that's brilliant. I said, so my, you know, my package obviously will be. And he said, no, you're going to stay on the same salary. And I said, so I'm good enough to do the job, but I'm not good enough to be paid fairly. And that was the kind of culture. And there was nothing you could really do about it.
I think definitely in that era, there was a, if you wanted to advance as a female, there was almost an expectation you had to do it in an alpha male style. And I think that has changed significantly, actually. And
thankfully.
I think, yeah, I absolutely, mean, thankfully. Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's now a case of, you know, you can be, you know, bringing your authentic self to work, and you know, you can sit here and go, yeah, I've got imposter syndrome, and yeah, that's okay, which absolutely.
You can also say I've had depression. All of these different things. The conversation, I think, around well-being and mental health, and, you know, what is appropriate for the workplace in behaviours, is absolutely completely different to 20 years ago.
Yeah, I would agree. But I think the inclusion piece also really matters to me. I think it's I'm constantly and increasingly reminded to check my privilege these days with, you know, lots of different political circumstances. And I think that it would be, you know, it's I think we're closer. I'm closer. You know, it would be easy to say equality has been achieved if you're looking for, you know, parity as a middle-aged white middle class, you know, female to middle-aged middle class white male. But actually, there's still a huge amount of progress to be done. And for me, it's when all women are, you know, approaching that parity line, not just a subsection.
So
I think I'm excited for that day.
I'm genuinely excited by the generation that's coming up. You know, Brandon's generation
really
of below. I'm not just saying. I'm honestly excited, and I'm reinvigorated by what they want to do. And they have more empathy. They have a greater understanding of what the challenges are. They have a greater drive to want to do something and create. And it's that creative element that is going to be so important. What I want to know is, maybe this is for both of you, why does International Women's Day matter?
I think it matters because I think it is important to celebrate the progress that's been made to date. We've just talked about the progress that's been made in the last, 20 years or so, 30 years.
God. Oh, 20 for me.
But I think it's also important, I think, to collaboratively commit to actually this progress that's still got to be made. You know, mm-hmm. I was having a conversation with a colleague recently who was sort of talking about his daughter, and he said, oh, you know, we're having lots of conversations about, you know, Me Too and things like that, and she's you know, absolutely, you know, shocked at the state of women's rights. And he said, and I had to sort of talk to her about what was happening 20 years ago, and actually progress has been made, which is not to say there's still a lot to do.
We have to stay on that trajectory. We have to keep going. Yeah. You can't be complacent about it.
No.
And I think, really, at this point, with the change in slight political landscape, we certainly can't be complacent about equality.
And I think it's very important as well when we, you know, celebrate International Women's Day, is that it almost becomes sort of that figment of reminder, because sometimes it can, you know, issues like that can be pushed slightly backwards. But I think of that as well, like events like Pride, for me particularly, remind me, because you know, I'm not part of the LGBT community, I'm not a woman, but it's like, you know, that constant like reminder. And obviously they do work throughout the year, but having one sort of big pillar day makes you go okay and step back and make you sort of like think about really what, you know, you've done in the sort of last year.
I think that's exactly right. I think that I was reading an interesting article the other day that sort of challenged or asked you to sort of explore where real power lay. And it was sort of saying a lot of people think real power lies with, you know, politicians and with lawmakers. But actually, it lies with the community and with the voice that with the people who can, you know, once something becomes a socially acceptable consensus opinion, then the lawmakers and the politicians will ratify that. Mm-hmm. Well, if that's, you know, something worthy of exploration, which I think it is, then you've got 51% of the population, and that's a huge community that actually, if they can collectively be heard, that's a real agent for change, I think. And if International Women's Day allows for that voice to be championed one day a year more loudly than the other days in the year, then great. I think it does matter.
So what Brandon, what do you think? What role do you think men can have in all of it?
I think the most important thing men can do is to continue to be aware and continue to appreciate that it's an issue and it's not something that's been fixed. I mean, in my life and through my upbringing and things like that, I think I maybe have like a different view than, you know, maybe even sort of, you know, people older than me. But I think it's always important for, you know, men to remember where we've come from. I mean, it's hard for me to relate in that way because I didn't come from that. I came into a world that was already shifting and changing, and I didn't come from a world. But I think it's really important for men to be sort of part of the conversation and part of that, because at the end of the day, as much as it is women that are part of the solution, the other 49% of the population, just as important in remembering building that.
I think that's absolutely right. I think I come again to the word inclusive. I don't think it's about equality, is not about the 51% beating the 49%. I think it's about, you know, collaborating together to achieve so that both win.
100%,
yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think that, you know, what we do have to recognise is that for centuries, you know, men have dominated, you know, the positions of power. They have been in the you know, political and the lawmakers, you know, in the majority. I think there's a joke doing the rounds on Twitter at the moment that if you say International Women's Day three times in front of the mirror, a man in a super dry t-shirt will turn up behind you saying, "When's International Man's Day?" And the point is that, you know, it's the there's been an imbalance for centuries, and I think all that International Women's Day is saying, let's work together to redress that balance a little bit. It doesn't have to be, you know, a bit like apprenticeships and graduates. It doesn't have to be neither one nor the other. There is this sort of spirit of both being able to work together.
So what do you reckon, what small thing can we all do to help raise equality? Mm-hmm. What do you reckon?
I think the most important thing to do is to make sure that you're doing lots of little things frequently and consistently. Honestly, because I think that they all add up to a big difference. I think that if you can listen, if you can speak, if you can act.
I agree. I think it's also in your actions. Yeah. And also I do think it's pulling people up. Not in a, you know, I'm not talking about in a trolling way, or, you know, an aggressive way. I do actually think that we need to have those conversations with people who perhaps are not on board with this, and have those conversations and pull people up in a civilized way and speak with them in a way that it is not aggressive, not patronizing, but ask them questions, listen to them, and come back with counter arguments, and come back, and that discussion point.
And I think that that's people.
And treat them as people, because I think what's happening is that when we don't have those discussions with people we don't agree with, I think it's just more and more polarization.
Mm-hmm. I agree completely. I think the it is right to do that, but I think you, before you sort of engage in that conversation, it's worth taking 5 minutes to just empathize with the person that you're about to interact with and think, what's it like to have walked in their shoes? Why do they have this opinion?
Absolutely.
What's their perspective? Because otherwise I think you're right, it just becomes it's a rant then, and nothing is achieved.
Yeah, we have to, so understanding more from each other from different points of view, even if we find those points of views very, very uncomfortable.
Yeah,
I think it's important. That's it. We're We're done. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Caroline.
Thank you.
If you're new listening to the podcast, remember to subscribe or follow the ZX Spectrum, all depending on the platform you're listening to. We'd love to also hear your feedback. So leave us a comment, you know, a rating, or generally sort of tell us what you think. I can be found sort of on brandonrouth.com.
I can be found on lizziehodgson.com.
And where can people find you, Caroline?
They can find Further My Future on furthermyfuture.com, Twitter handle at furthermyfuture. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you very much, Caroline. Thank you, Brandon.
Thank you, Lizzie.
And goodbye.